Podcast. My name is Pastor Kevin Roberts, and today is March 1st, unbelievable, 2017. It is Ash Wednesday, and so we're going to have a service at 7 o'clock. I get the biggest jokes out of people getting in my line, expecting me with my tremor to do a nice, steady cross on their foreheads. So if you're in my line tonight, you're not going to get a nice-looking cross, but you get some sort of design, not done on purpose. Today I'm excited. I'm excited about interviewing Randall Slayton Sr., a.k.a. my Michael Jackson buddy. And the reason I'm telling you this is when Michael Jackson passed away, I think it was 2005, wasn't it?
I get dates mixed up.
Yeah, I think it was 2005. That I have been a closet Michael Jackson fanatic. And it killed me when I found out he passed away.
Yeah. So
I went to see This Is It, which is a documentary, came out about a year after. And I remember I saw it by myself. And I said to Randall, I said, you need to see it with me. And so both of us went to see This Is It. And dude, I don't go to movies with other people. I don't even go to movies with my wife. And so we both had a cry fest.
Yeah, we were both sitting there scared to look at each other to see who was see if we were crying.
But we're all Michael Jackson fanatics. But anyway, that's so Randall and I, how long have you been going to the church?
Somewhere probably around
I've been here for 18 years.
Okay, probably somewhere around 14, 15 years.
That long?
Something like that, yeah. I left the club circuit, playing with the band in 97.
Okay.
And then I went in hiatus for a couple of years, and then Brooke contacted me and eventually got out here and been here ever
since. Because I remember your daughter, Melanie, she was a teenager when I first met her, and she's in her mid-30s now.
Right.
She started coming before.
Right.
And I guess broken connection, and then you've been playing a bass. In fact, you have a relationship with that bass, don't you?
Yeah, me and my sweetheart's been together. be 40 years this year.
40 years with that same bass.
40 years old this year.
Wow. Yeah. And see, thank God that you don't leave your bass the church, because a few months ago we were robbed, which it was... Yeah. The bass, Jeff's bass,
music man, beautiful, beautiful instrument.
And he was emotionally connected to that bass because his parents gave it to him. So anyway, you have your same bass for 40 years.
Right.
So let's go back in the 1970s. They were good to you. And tell us about how you grew up, where you grew up, and how you really had the love for music.
Okay, well, I grew up in East L.A. I went to Roosevelt High School. I graduated in the summer of 70.
1970?
Yeah.
Okay.
Back then we had winter graduation class and the summer graduation class. They weren't combined, so...
Oh, really?
Yeah, so it was summer 70.
Okay.
My dad was a sax player.
Mm-hmm.
I
didn't know that.
Yeah. Okay. Actually, my first jam session was with my dad and a couple of his friends. You had Max on drums, Moles on piano, and my dad on tenor sax.
Wow.
So I'm coming running in the house from playing baseball outside. I'm a kid, right?
Right.
I'm in middle school, and my dad had bought me an upright bass.
Mm-hmm.
And I come running in the house from playing baseball, and they were downstairs jamming.
Okay.
And I came in and it's like, wow, and come on, Randy, sit in with us, come on. And they kind of convinced me, to sit in and play with. I had no idea what I was doing.
Okay.
But that was my first jam session with them.
And they were encouraging you. So that's how you began to get the love from the music and the love for bass.
Yeah.
I'm not a music guy, but to me, you're an incredible bass player. And the way that you play is just very, your body's really into your bass and you're moving with the bass. And for me, with no coordination, there's no way. There's no way. I can't even dance, let alone play any instrument. Yeah. So I'm impressed. So you started playing in the early 70s. And so tell us about that.
Actually, I started in middle school.
Okay.
Okay. I wanted to play guitar. My cousin played guitar. I wanted to learn how to play guitar.
Okay.
They didn't teach guitar in my day. They had string instruments, violin, viola, cello, and bass. So I picked a bass. And you know how big an upright bass is.
Yeah.
I used to carry that thing home from school, and it was about 3 miles home, you know. But, and then I went into high school and kind of got into football and then the marching band. No basses in the marching band.
Yeah.
I played tuba.
Oh, you did?
You know, but, and then went into the service.
Okay. Now, you were in Vietnam, right?
I was not in Vietnam. Okay. I was in the Army during the Vietnam era.
Okay.
72, 74.
Now, we had this conversation a couple of weeks ago, because my father-in-law was in the Vietnam era, too, but he was actually in Vietnam, too.
Right.
But what was interesting is when you guys came back, even if you weren't in Vietnam, you were thrown into that category.
Right.
And so tell us, after serving the military, that basically how it went when you came back from service in Vietnam.
Okay. The I got drafted in July 31st, 1972. I was one of the last bunch of guys to get drafted because at that time they were actually pulling troops out. They weren't sending any more troops over.
Okay.
My dad was in the Army. My uncle was an airborne ranger. My oldest brother was military police in the Army.
Right.
The brother just above me was in the Navy. Mm-hmm. He served off the coast of Vietnam. And then I got my papers from the government saying, we want you.
Okay.
And I was proud to go.
Yeah.
All the men in my family were veterans of the military, and I was my turn, and I was going to go, you know.
Serve the country.
Serve the country, and I was, if they needed me to go to Vietnam, then I was ready to go.
Right.
Okay, so I felt the same compassion as the guys that actually went over there.
Right, right.
So served my 2 years. After my basic training, they changed my orders. Instead of going to advanced infantry, they sent me to an air defense missile program, and I'd served 21 months in El Paso. But I still felt that fire within me as a military man.
Right.
So I come home, and, you know, I'm expecting this big parade. And
then you see the pictures of World War
II. Right,
right. Kissing your girl.
Yeah. A line of people waiting at the airport.
Parade.
You know.
Okay.
And
they do that now. They do that with the military now.
Yeah.
That they welcome the veterans. So you came, flown back in, and then what happened?
Actually, I drove home from El Paso.
Okay.
16 hours, I drove straight through. I was just so anxious to get home.
Okay.
And I got home, and nothing.
Nothing.
Nothing. Mom was there, you know. I mean, you know, mothers are mothers, and she greeted me and welcomed me and was so happy to see me.
Right.
But, and the family, you know, and, but that was about it.
Yeah.
You know, and I sat around for about a week, and you know, I had a few thousand dollars in my pocket from you know, and I turned to my mom. I said, Mom, you know what? I'm going to San Francisco. I'll be gone a couple of weeks or so, 10 days.
Okay.
I'll see you when I get back. And I was so heartbroken. I was so lonely that I just took off. I jumped in my Volkswagen, had a little Volkswagen, drove to San Francisco and just hung out for 10 days.
Now, during that loneliness, were you trying to figure out life, trying to figure out your direction?
I was.
Were you bitter or all the above?
I don't know if it was really bitterness.
Okay.
But I didn't understand.
Right.
You know? And then in San Francisco, and then, you know, hanging out, then I begin to understand. I'm seeing what's going on.
Right. Because in San Francisco, now, this is before my era, but Haight Ashbury was a big thing in San Francisco, the hippie movement. And that, if you go to Haight Ashbury now, there's still hippies there. They're still living in the late 70s, early 70s. So they're stuck in this time warp.
Right, they're sitting there in a daze.
Yeah, and they're total peace people, anti-war.
Right.
So now you're in San Francisco trying to figure out your life.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I'm still looking like a GI. I got the buzz cut, right. You know, my body's in best shape it's ever been in, you know. But it was cool, okay. You know, and I understand. I was trying to figure out what I was going to do now.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And so that was July 31st. Well, the beginning of August 1974.
42 years. 42? Yeah.
Since then?
42. Wow. My wife was born.
Really?
So okay. In November of 74.
Okay.
So then you figured out, then what did you, how did you meet your wife?
Actually, our families knew each other.
Okay.
Back then in Boyle Heights where we grew up, there was a 4-block radius. And 99% of the property in that radius was either owned or rented by African-American people. It was a real close community. Everybody knew each other.
Right.
We all went to the church that my great-grandmother founded, Mark Carmel Southern Baptist Church on First Street, right around the corner from Light and Life Christian School.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And we all went to church there, and if somebody had a party, everybody was there, uh-huh. You know, and everybody knew each other.
Right.
But Shirley's 6 years younger than I.
Okay. So you're a cradle robber.
I knew I shouldn't have said that. I knew you were going to go there.
Look who's talking.
I knew, yeah, exactly, right?
Look who's talking. Okay. Sorry, she's 6 years younger.
But we knew each other just as community.
Okay.
You know, so we kind of just ran into each other after she got out of high school.
Mm.
Okay. And she was going to Compton College, and I used to go see her out there.
Okay.
And then one thing led to another.
Right.
She was living with her mom, so we got her mom to come out and stay in an apartment building where we were, you know, as things evolved. My mom still lives there, matter of fact.
Oh, did she really?
Yes. And one thing led to another, then come Melanie and Randall Jr. Yeah. And
the family of a boy and a girl, perfect little family.
And well 36 years later, you know, here we are.
So you've had your 36th wedding anniversary?
That would be this Valentine's Day.
Oh, Valentine's Day. So you had it. Yeah. This is during after Valentine's. 36 years.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a long time. That's a big commitment, too, 36 years.
It is.
So, cool. It's good for you guys.
Yeah, I don't know. I give her the credit.
Yeah.
I'm not the most easiest person to live with, especially if I have a gig. If I need to play somewhere, you know, that day is like everything's shut off. Everything's shut out.
Right. And when did it take you to figure out you're not the easiest person to live with? Because I thought when I first got married that I'm a piece of cake to live with. And my wife will remind me continually that I'm not easy to be married to. And I think I am, because I live with myself. But I think it's great knowledge to know that we're not easy to live with.
Nobody's easy to live with. No. And the sooner you admit it, then the better you are, and you can continue to get over it. I'm not perfect. I never will be perfect.
No.
You know, I have a temper. And I'm an ex-military man.
Right.
And I like things like I like things.
Right.
You know what I mean? And
in order.
In order.
Yeah.
And where I could find them.
Yeah.
I don't like looking around for stuff. Where's my toenail clipper? I can't find it. It's not where it's supposed to be.
You sit there and Randall's hitting his leg. Is that what you do? Just slide your leg? Start yelling? Where's my toenail clipper?
That's why I walk with a limp.
Where's my toenail clipper? That's funny.
Yeah, so
No, it's interesting. I came here, I moved to L.A. in 1978, and I was in a church now, Amber Church of Nazarene, but all the youth that were part of that church were from East L.A.,
mm-hmm.
and so I was the only white boy that would go to East L.A., And I remember they took me down Whittier Boulevard on a Wednesday night in a 1974 Honda Civic. So you got this white guy looking like a joke. And it was Memo and Oswaldo and Daniel and stuff like that. We're all making fun of me because I'm this white kid going down Whittier Boulevard. I never saw a black guy living in East L.A.
Okay, if you did, it was probably me. Somebody I knew, somebody in my family, one of my cousins or my brothers or something.
So what's interesting and fascinating, how was it like being African-American and living in East L.A.?
Okay, when I was seven, we moved away from Boyle Heights, where the black community was, and we moved to City Terrace.
Okay.
Now, from the hills in City Terrace, you could look and see Boyle Heights. Mm-hmm. Okay? And at that time, it was primarily brown people that were living up there.
Okay.
So from seven on up to about 13 or 14, all my friends were brown.
Okay.
You know, I went to Harrison Street School and then Belvedere Middle School.
Okay.
And my two best friends, George Gutierrez and Danny De La Luz, you know, we walked to school together every day. And the world was fine at that time. You know, I'm a kid.
Right.
I'm being a kid. The world's great.
Right.
Okay.
And you didn't notice a difference between your friends and you?
No, I didn't notice. They didn't notice.
They didn't notice, okay.
I could run into the front door of their house and say hi and run into the kitchen and open the refrigerator and get something to eat. And they could do the same thing with me at my house.
So it's almost like this little bubble or this little cocoon that you lived in the Hispanic area.
Right.
Okay.
So then came the 60s, civil rights.
Right.
And then from our house during the Watts riots, we lived on top of the hill. Mm. And from our house, you could see the embers of the fires burning in Los Angeles. Mm. And all of a sudden, I mean, I was coming along and all of a sudden I discovered my blackness. Okay. Because the community, it was a different attitude towards us when this was happening.
Right.
It was like the black people are going to burn down Los Angeles, and they're black too.
Okay, so you were knowing that they're looking at you differently now.
Yes,
because of the Watts riots.
My two friends were my two friends, through thick and thin.
Okay,
matter of fact, Mousy, Danny De La Luz, he was one of the few people that ever wrote me when I was in the service.
Okay.
Okay, they were my friends. Was nothing there, but other people in the community. You could see the difference. You could feel the difference. You know.
No, I mean, it's interesting because I want to ask you this. It's almost like it's how would you wear it? Like a racist race star. Like you can tell when people look at you like you're racist towards me. Could you tell then that people are like looking at you different, and all of a sudden you're.
Sure. Want, you could feel it.
Yeah, that people are feeling towards your race.
You could, you know, it's a sense. It's like almost like a smell.
Yeah,
you know, you could feel it.
Even to this day, I assume that you could feel it.
Sure,
because that's what. Because me, with white privilege, I walk around naive to the planet sometimes, but the people that talk to of color, they have this. They know when they're talking to somebody that is a racist. They know it. And so you were feeling that too.
Yes.
How did you deal with it?
I discovered blackness. I discovered my blackness.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Okay.
I discovered who I was, who my people were.
Right.
And then I started getting into black history and stuff like that, you know, and finding out and watching and learning.
Right.
Okay. That's one thing I do very carefully. I listen to what people say when they talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
I remember what they say. Okay, we could be having a casual conversation, but I'm listening and I'm remembering what you say. You might not remember what you said, but I could bring it back at you later and say, "Hey, you remember you said this?"
Yeah.
And this is just a way of protecting myself against this type of stuff, you know, because when you listen, you could hear stuff in people's voices. You could hear some of the words they use. I mean, you know, you could call me paranoid if you want, but I've been through some extreme racism, and you have to be ready to protect yourself. You have to be prepared.
Right. No, it makes a lot of sense where you just... You have to be very cognizant of certain words that you go, okay, I don't trust this guy, I would assume. Or I'm not going to open my eye, or I'm going to watch my back towards this guy. And I'm assuming it's the opposite, too.
Probably.
No, the opposite meaning that you look at somebody and go, I have nothing to worry about. I have nothing. This person I could trust. You know, like, in a sense that they're very open to... racial differences are very open to who you are as a black man. That's interesting. So, go ahead.
I don't. I'm not this hardliner person that's always trying to pull something out of somebody. Yeah. You know what I mean? But when you talk to me, you're a stranger, and you talk to me, I'm listening very carefully.
Yeah. Oh, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
So during the 1970s, the 60s, during the Watt riots, and discovering, as you say, your blackness, and moving forward, then your 70s were a decade for you of just kind of getting into the music scene, wasn't it? And doing the nightclub scene.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
I finally, after about a year or two of being home and trying some different things, I got back into school.
Mm-hmm.
I started playing again, you know, and I joined in a group with my cousins,
right.
A group called the Warriors. There was an article that came out a few months ago about us back then.
Oh, really?
Yeah, how we brought punk rock into East L.A.
Oh, that's cool. You know,
I never thought what we were doing was punk rock. We were just doing music from the heart, straight, clean, just pure, creative music.
Right.
There were no drugs involved. There were no Hollywood scene involved. Mm. There were no producers involved. I mean, there were producers. Yeah. But we would go in somebody's backyard, dirt, pull our instruments in, pull up one little light bulb, and we would start jamming for nothing.
Yeah.
Just the pleasure to go out there and play. And we did that a lot in East L.A., and we had parties where there were hundreds of people in backyards, you know, and we were playing. And where helicopters would come around and the police, they would think it was a riot, but it was just a rock show.
Yeah.
You know? But, yeah, that's... That's how I really got into it.
Right.
And then we started playing clubs and stuff. I was working at night on Graveyard. I was going to East L.A. College in the morning. I was practicing every day after school and then going back to work, you know. And it got too much.
Yeah.
I remember my astronomy, the first class I had in the morning. I used to fall asleep in that class every day.
Mm.
And one day, the professor was going to show some slides, so they dimmed the lights.
Right.
When I woke up...
Don't dim the lights.
Drool coming down my face. The lights were bright. Everybody in the classroom was staring at me. You know, and it was like, was I snoring?
They blame them for dimming the lights.
Yeah. Something had to give.
How'd your dad get into the boxing stuff?
Dad was a fighter in the Army.
Your dad was?
Yeah.
Okay.
And after he came out, I guess he continued his interests.
Mm-hmm.
Dad, there was the Main Street gym downtown L.A.
Mm-hmm.
It was on Main Street, obviously.
Yeah.
And this was probably one of the first gyms, boxing gyms in L.A.
Right.
And that's where my dad used to go and hang out. And I went down there a few times with him. And okay. I remember this guy, Duke. I mean, if you ever saw an old movie with these, this old boxing gym and right. these characters,
yeah.
that was exactly it right there.
Okay.
Duke had a stubby cigar that used to hang out his mouth 24 hours a day, you know. And my dad learned a lot of his stuff from him.
Okay.
And then he just, he started training fighters from that point and went on from there.
So he ended up owning the gym eventually.
Actually, he bought another gym okay. or had another gym built
okay.
in Watts.
Right.
Okay, on 108th and Broadway.
Right.
And back then it was called Broadway Gym and Health Spa. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And this, back then, he had made quite a bit of money in the 70s with mm-hmm. Ken Norton. I don't know if...
I know Ken Norton.
Yeah.
Don't know him directly.
He fought Ali three times and he broke Muhammad Ali's jaw.
Okay.
And Dad made a lot of money back then. So they built this gym and it was state of the art back then.
Right.
Right? It had a steam room, it had the sauna, you know, everything in there. And so that's how that worked out.
That's cool. So one thing that I think is fascinating, because your relationship with your dad was pretty good, wasn't it? Or what was it? Was it rough?
It was good.
Okay.
When we when we interacted.
Okay. Because one thing that I know, when my mother was at the beginning of dementia, I remember you and I were talking about it.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the things is, you did not give me answers. You didn't say. I think you said to me, it's going to get worse.
Yeah, it gets worse.
It's getting worse. Which, to me, you were speaking from experience.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, you didn't give me these stupid Christian answers. You know, that, oh, don't worry, trust God, it's going to get better. You just flat out said, it's going to get worse. And it has. I mean, she's in stage 7 dementia. But... you started sharing with me back then about your dad's last days, which I think are so powerful about, because a lot of us are going to lose, all of us to a time, we're going to lose a parent.
Mm-hmm.
Or, God forbid, that we lose a child. And so either way, it's hard. So share with me again about your relationship with your dad and how it ended. I thought that was deep. Dad,
I get my worth ethics from him. Dad left.
You're both military people.
Yeah. Dad left the house at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Okay.
He was a truck driver.
Right.
Okay. So he went to work. He drove his truck all day, his full shift. Okay. Then he left the docks and he went to the gym.
Mm-hmm.
He stayed at the gym till 7:30, 8 o'clock at night.
Wow.
Working with his fighters, and then he came home. So during the week, it was, hi, Dad. Good night, Dad.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But I appreciated what he was doing. I knew what he was doing.
Right.
He was working.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't out in the club partying. He wasn't out, you know, chasing women and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
He was out working for the most part.
Right.
Okay? So then... later, we would, you know, do something on the weekends, but as things progressed, you know, I went out and got married, and mm-hmm. we're having we're raising our kids.
Mm-hmm.
We'd see Dad on Christmas and Thanksgiving right. and his birthday and stuff like that, mm-hmm. and we got along fine for a while. I was hanging out at the gym, but it really wasn't my thing.
Right.
And so... We fast forward 40 years, and, you know, Dad was getting sick.
Mm.
He's having trouble with his back.
Yeah.
Now, Dad worked with heavyweight fighters,
mm.
okay? And they used to wear this padding around their waist,
right.
the trainer,
mm.
and the fighters would hit them. You know, and they'd have their mittens up, and the fighters would be hitting their
right.
mitts and then
yeah.
shooting those body shots and stuff. And... Dad says, oh, one of my heavyweights, you know, hit me in the kidney. And
right.
that's why I got a little problem back there.
Yeah.
And he kept saying that, and he kept saying that. And then he started having trouble walking.
Mm.
Okay?
Mm.
So my sister said, well, I'm going to go to the doctor with you.
Yeah.
So I went to the doctor, okay, and Dad's kind of fibbing to us the whole time. He has bone cancer at this point.
So did he know that?
We don't know if he knew that or not.
Okay.
But he kept blaming it on these body shots that he was taking from these heavyweights.
Yeah.
Now, one of these heavyweights could hit one of us in the body and we're down out for good. Right. We might go straight to the graveyard from there. You know?
Yeah, I would just be on my knees.
I mean, Dad was 165 pounds, perfect shape, much better shape than I, okay, when we discovered this.
Mm-hmm.
So, Mom passed in 83. That's, you know, a whole other story. So, times goes on. Well, no, I'm sorry. He had prostate cancer.
Okay.
Prostate cancer, if you do what you're supposed to do, you can live a continued productive life.
Yeah.
So he gets his medication thing happening. His girlfriend, she's taking care of him very well.
Right.
And, you know, he's taking his pills when he's supposed to.
Right.
Okay. She ended up dying of cancer suddenly.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay, sent Dad into a depression.
Yeah,
spiraling down. So he's not taking care of himself.
Right.
From that prostate, it went into the bone.
Okay. And when it's in the bone, it's
yeah. So we're talking a year.
Okay. That's quick.
So, at this time, my sister and I are running a gym. I'm physically managing the gym. She's handling the paperwork and the finances. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm leaving my job in the day, going out, staying at the gym till around 9 o'clock p.m. Right. Closing up.
Same work ethic as your dad.
We had an assistant that was there in the daytime while I was at work, and then I'd come in and he'd go do his thing. And so, on the weekends, I'm going to see him, make sure he's okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So then we fast forward a little bit and it gets to the point where we have to put him in a convalescent home.
Okay.
Okay.
And that's hard.
That's, you know, I never want to go to a convalescent home.
Yeah.
Okay. We didn't have any other choice.
Right.
So he's in a convalescent home. I'm hollering at these people every day.
Yeah.
You know, because nothing.
You have a temper.
Yeah, I do have a temper.
Yeah.
And nothing's perfect, so I'm not happy.
And nothing's in order for your toenail clipper.
Okay.
Okay.
Nothing's perfect, so I'm not happy. Okay. Yeah.
All right. So you're seeing your dad suffering.
I'm seeing him dwindle away as time goes by. He goes from 165 pounds, and the last time I saw him, I mean, it got to the point where I was visiting him every day, and I'm taking him from the Wilshire, from Fairfax District, over to UCLA to get treatment and such, and to Kaiser, and you know, I mean, because he's at this point, he's not talking.
Right.
Oh, in between, okay, a doctor comes up and says, "Oh, you have something wrong with your back. We want to do back surgery."
Mm-hmm.
And Dad says, "Oh, is it a pop?" Because he can't walk at this time.
Right.
Okay, was it a possibility that I'll be able to walk and get with my fighters, work with my fighters again? And this doctor tells him, oh, there is a possibility. My dad's 82 years old, dude. He's got cancer of the bone, and you want to do back surgery on him.
Back surgery, and also give him hope that he can take another hit.
What is wrong with you?
Okay.
So me and my sister are there, and we're like, Dad, come on, man. You know, Dad's, you know, if he tells me there's a possibility, then I want to do it.
So in a sense, your dad's looking for hope.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Or
okay,
something
so
normal.
Back surgery comes in, and he just gets, he's going like a plane coming down to the ocean, man, straight down from that point.
Okay.
So, I had to take him to Kaiser Permanente one day. And he's in a wheelchair. He's not talking. He's not eating.
Mm-hmm.
He's dwindled down to about 100 pounds now. I'm watching this in a year's period of time. My hero, okay, is beginning to dwindle away at this point. And so,
do you ever, in the point, because I know it's hard to talk, but do you get to the point where you're just praying and saying, God, are you frustrated, God? Are you praying at that time? Or are you just going, okay, what in the world is going on?
I'm a realist, Pastor.
Okay.
You know, we all got to go sometime.
Right.
I saw, what the progression of things is telling me that this is not going to get any better. That's why I said to you it's going to get worse.
Yeah.
Because certain things to our knowledge today, there's no answer for. Okay?
No.
So.
It's just life.
I'm not mad at God. My dad's 82 years old. He lived a wonderful life.
Right, right.
You know what I mean? He supported us. He provided for us. Mm-hmm. I'm proud of him, and I wish I was like him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, yeah, we all got to go sometime.
Yeah.
But the thing was, it hurt. What hurt so much is he went like this.
Yeah.
You know, inch by inch by inch by inch. Once that cancer gets inside of you, man, it's like a little Pac-Man.
Yeah.
And it just goes. And so
it's almost to a point where you lose dignity. And
yeah.
You just go.
Yeah.
Yeah. And to me, it's not I'm afraid to die. It's afraid how I'm going to die. You know, and I think, you know, with my biggest fear is having dementia and just being in a vegetative state. And, you know, you start thinking of all that stuff. And you're right, because your biggest fear is I don't want to be in a convalescent home. And I want to make that clear to my wife and my family, because she's 6 years younger than you.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And my wife's...
And women, wives outlast their husbands
and
anyway.
So my wife's 12 years younger. Okay. So basically, she's... Yeah.
Well, maybe they can hang out later.
So going through the life, while we wind up the podcast... That basically discovering your blackness and moving on to, you know, the military where you didn't get much of a welcome back. You didn't get any welcome back. Then going through gigs and stuff and playing and then losing your father. Just a few years ago. What year did he die? Do you remember?
Dad?
Yeah.
2002.
Okay, 2002. And it's interesting because that grief doesn't go away, does it?
No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. You try to make sense out of it.
Yeah.
You know, and you try to move on from that point. But, you know, you look at the good side of
right.
it. Right. Like I say, his life.
Because the thing is, I think this is one of the biggest lies. Time heals all wounds.
No.
Because you're talking about 2002,
right?
Which is about 15 years ago.
Seems like yesterday.
Yeah. So that time stuff is belonging. I don't think I can deal with it. And so, anyway, let's say if somebody's listening to this podcast that, like myself, that is discovering that their parents are getting older, that they're going through a difficult time, that they're thinking, oh my goodness, this is not... What advice would you give someone, or would you give advice to somebody on how... what their perspective should be in a situation with the hindsight that you have now?
That's a good one, Pastor.
I know.
Now
we're in a podcast and you're staying 10 minutes to think about it.
Well, like I told myself last year, I'm going to stop being a Mr. Know-it-all.
But I think it would be helpful, even for me. You know what?
You know what? Life happens. Life takes over.
Mm-hmm.
God takes over.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Right.
We want to keep in fellowship with God's people.
Yeah.
That helps so much.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even in raising your kids,
mm-hmm.
you know, the Christian family, it takes a village to raise a child, and I was talking to Brooke about this the other day. It takes a village to raise a child, and the church village is a perfect source to raise your children.
Right.
So just stay
within the body.
Yeah.
Stay within the church.
Yeah. You know.
Okay.
Because the way I was running,
mm-hmm.
you know, I couldn't have raised my kids, you know, we couldn't have raised the kids by ourselves.
Right.
They went to Lighten Life Christian School.
Okay.
That was a whole family right there.
Right.
Brooke, you. We right. knew Ruben, you know right. what I mean? And Esther, and it was just a family, it was a village, mm-hmm. And by having your kids around all these people and their kids, it, yeah. it just so we're so yeah. lucky that yeah. Our children are great people.
Yeah, good.
You know. Good. My wife is a great person. I got to make sure I put that in there. Because she has to be great in order to deal with me, okay?
She's a saint.
Yes, she is.
She's a saint. Yes, she is. So thank you, Randall, for sharing your story. And thank you for listening to the podcast. And remember, this weekend is the weekend that we're going to have one service. That is 10 o'clock on Sunday morning. So we won't have the Saturday night service. We won't have the 9 o'clock or the 10:45. We're going to have a 10 o'clock service. And if you see Randall playing the bass this Sunday, tell him that you listen to his podcast and thank you for listening to it. If you did not enjoy it, don't tell him.
Don't say anything.
Anyway.
No, that's okay. I'm a realist. You can tell me.
Every day is a gift from God. Use it wisely. God bless you. And we'll have another podcast next week. Have a great week. God bless.
Thank you, Pastor.
You did a good job.
Thanks.
Be good luck.